Good evening. Just as a maybe a background, it was probably something like 15 months ago, Shyla sent me an email asking me if I'd be willing to give a talk here. And of course, it was pretty easy to say yes. You know, I mean, 15 months seems like quite a ways away. You know, and I thought, well, that's easy enough. But then a week later, she sent me an email saying, so, okay, so now give me the title of your talk. And I thought, title of my talk? I usually don't write a talk until like a day before. You know, I usually like to see kind of what's juicy for me, you know, kind of what's up, what am I curious about or what am I struggling with. So, you know, it was kind of a stretch to come up with a title for something 15 months away. And what I settled on was Listening to the Wise Heart. And I wasn't sure why I chose that title, but it turned out that at the New Spirit Rock New Year's retreat, I think I found out why. It's an 8-day retreat, and I came and I sat for the first day, and you know, in the Vipassana world, there's a lot of instructions, a lot of meditation techniques to be taught, to be learned. You know, I've received a lot of instruction on how to do something as simple as noticing the breath. And in fact, I've taught a lot of instructions on how to meditate. And so on the first day, I sat and I followed my breath, and my mind became more and more distracted. I had a lot of physical pain. I kept thinking, well, I'm not doing it quite right. I kept changing what I was doing, thinking of all the instructions. And over the course of the first day, it just became more and more miserable. It was just like, oh my God, you know, what have I been doing for the last 13 years? So I decided I'm going to just throw out all of the instructions I've ever received on how to meditate. And fortunately, at the beginning of the second day, they told us we were going to do one section of loving-kindness meditation. And so I started there. And what I realized was that on the first day, when I looked back at that, I realized as I was trying to do the meditation practice, I didn't really have much heartfelt connection to it. I didn't really care about the pain that I was experiencing. I didn't really care about the thoughts. It was, and I kept wanting something better. And that not caring, I realized, was maybe kind of at the heart of what seemed to be sort of going wrong. And so then I started with doing loving kindness as was being guided that morning. And I started to think, how can I connect with my heart? How can I actually connect with something that I care about? What is it in this moment that I actually care about and want to pay attention to? And I realized that my heart wasn't in it. My heart wasn't in the practice at that time. And just continuing to note the muscle aches and the joint aches and all, you know, everything else, I realized I couldn't just do that out of some sense of willpower. So the first thing I did was decide, you know, I think I'm just going to get as comfortable as I can. So I went to the manager's office. I got some ibuprofen. I took that. I got my wool blanket and I wrapped that around me, keep my body nice and warm and kind of relaxed. I decided to let go of really trying to sit as still as possible. I decided, okay, well, if I need to move a little bit, that's okay. And I realized I didn't really know what my heart cared about, but I knew that I could at least attend my heart. So I just made the whole practice around paying attention to the heart center, changing the breathing. One of my teachers is Tenisaru Bhikkhu, Tanjef, and he had instructed me on how to imagine bringing the breath in, say, through the chest or through the back or down through the top of the head. And so that was the practice that I started, was just bringing my breath in, either through my chest or often through my back, through the heart center, and just letting the breath soothe and warm and nourish the heart center. Without trying to do anything else, you know, no metta phrases, no noting, no particular rigorous practice, just breathing into the heart center and letting my awareness just rest with it, just rest in that area. Being attentive, listening, but really not trying to make anything in particular happen. Treating the heart with a greater respect, I think, than I often give it in practice. And so I worked that way. For the whole second day of the retreat, I did nothing but just let my attention rest with the heart center, breathe through the heart center, do what it took to have as much physical ease as I could on the second day of a retreat. That's often kind of hard because the week before I had been on vacation in Wisconsin and I hadn't brought my Zafu, so I hadn't been sitting for a week. And then now I was sitting, I don't know how many, 8 or 10 hours a day. So, there was a lot of accommodation that had to happen. I had also remembered a teaching that my teacher Gil has said, and it's a quote from somebody famous, but I don't remember who it was, about how the entire practice takes place in the heart, that it all happens here. And as a scientist and as a Westerner, it seems like most everything's taking place up here. So it's really kind of a shift to go from up here to down here. And then at the beginning of the third day, what started to come up were images of the way that I had betrayed or mistreated my heart's deepest desires in my life, the ways that I hadn't been true to my heart, true to myself, true to my deepest wishes. And I decided that could I then hold those memories, those images, the feeling that came up of not being true to yourself, not being true to myself, with gentleness and kindness, with spaciousness, letting it be there as it needed to be. And then bringing a sense of forgiveness, forgiving, I mean, in some cases, it was forgiving other people, like my ex-wife. But partly it was, but a lot of it was just forgiving myself for having acted the way I had acted against my own best interest, against my own, you know, best, against my own best interest. And that really shifted things for me. You know, that really moved the practice from the ideas that I had about what practice ought to happen, you know, kind of the conceptual and intellectual and, you know, kind of thought arena. And here I have to say, sometimes there's this word citta in Pali, that I think it's Pali, that is often translated as heart-mind, like as heart and mind being the same. And I think what I experience, I'm not quite sure how that works for others, but for me, I often experience heart and thinking or mind process, brain process, as separate. Perhaps there's a way that they can be more integrated, but I realize that growing up in the West, white, middle-class male, that a great deal of value and training had gone into developing the intellect, you know, developing the rational, well, I think it's rational, you know, the kind of the rational, the conceptual. And I hadn't had much training in how to listen to and cultivate and appreciate the knowledge and wisdom that comes from the heart. And so it's been a long process for me. And I think for myself, and I suspect for probably everyone, the desire to love and be loved is really one of those core drives that can't really happen without the heart being involved. And so, as my marriage ended, then I went into, you know, psychotherapy to start looking inward and exploring this arena, and then spending time in men's groups where I'd actually get a chance to explore what's the emotional landscape inside the, you know, kind of in the male psyche. And so all those kind of set the groundwork for then coming to Buddhist meditation. I mean, all of them were valuable to me, and I still, at the end of all of that, I still recognized some unsatisfactoriness. You know, like I thought at some point it's just going to be like the lights are going to turn on, everything's going to be happy, you know, I'll have made it. And when that didn't happen using the psychological tools alone, then going into meditation gave me greater skill to look further at what was going on inside. What I was trying to either protect in the heart, or what kind of, or what was my intellect trying to protect itself from by shutting off the heart. So I felt very grateful seemingly accidentally, I discovered Buddhism and meditation practice as a way to start exploring even deeper some of the psychological work that I did could work only kind of at the verbal level, and the meditation actually took me beyond words, beyond the verbal, and beyond conceptual to more direct experience. So to bring this maybe back to, so what did the Buddha teach, or what do I get from sanghas like this, teaching environments like this, that are helpful for cultivating this listening to the wise heart? And I don't have an exhaustive list. This was just sort of what came to me. But I think first, the first practice that I learned was the Brahmaviharas. And that was back in 1998. Shaila had just come back from doing a three-month training in the Brahmaviharas. I think it was at Sharpham College in England. And so I was one of her first students of that, of those practices back then. And I could really see the value in them. And I think for me to even, well, first of all, I was curious, since you're all here, how many of you have had some kind of Brahmavihara training or experience? Okay, there's quite a few. So those of you that haven't, I don't know if but the root teacher here, Shaila Catherine, is, I'll say, a world expert on Brahmaviharas. She's quite skilled, and I would encourage you to explore that if that's of interest to you. So I'll go over a little bit about what these practices are about. The foundational one is called metta. Sometimes that's called loving kindness, or loving friendliness, or just kindness. It's cultivating goodwill towards oneself and others. Now, it sounds, maybe that's kind of simple. What I found in doing that practice is that there are several, benefits or stages, perhaps. It's often taught by repeating phrases, wishing safety, wishing happiness, wishing health, and wishing peace to oneself or whoever the person is that one is directing this towards. And you might think that immediately you would start to feel wonderful and, like the heart lighting up. But often that doesn't happen. You find yourself just doing these phrases and it seems like nothing's really happening. My interpretation of that is the first part is you start to see what prevents you from wishing well for yourself or wishing well for others. So it's like what's blocking that energy of the heart from coming forward. I was thinking as an example, I don't know if how many of you noticed what happened in your own hearts and minds when the 12-step people ended their meeting and all started talking and laughing and making noise. Was there a sense of happiness for them having, just completed their meeting? Or was there something else? Was there a little, irritation or, when are they gonna leave? That kind of thing. So the metta practice can help help us see what's blocking the heart, what's blocking the ability to just wish well for other people. As that practice deepens, and I'll describe this sort of in a linear fashion, but really these things come and go. So it's not like you just start here and you end with, a fully bright and radiant heart. There's times when it seems like it's a very joyous process, and other times when it really seems to be more of a challenge. So there's kind of seeing what stands in the way. Then there's also a tuning in. There's the development of the ability to listen and tune in to the heart. And actually tonight, so I was doing metta meditation while we were sitting, and I noticed that actually the part of my experience that seemed most disturbed wasn't the heart, but it was my head. You know, like I think the intellect was still kind of like, is this okay? You know, I mean, I could feel the resistance going on more in the mind rather than in the heart. The heart seemed fine with just wishing everyone in the room to be happy and healthy and safe and peaceful. Yeah, so there's the kind of what stands in the way, then there's a tuning in to the heart, and then there's also, I think, a strengthening of the heart that happens as you do this practice. That it isn't just that you become more sensitive to it. I think that the heart gets stronger. There's a greater capacity for courage and acting skillfully rather than doing what seems easiest. The second of the Brahmavihara practices that are taught in this scene is mudita. It's taking delight in the joy of others. And so I see that, I mean, kind of a way to just synopsize that practice. In a way, it's learning to be able to let your heart resonate with the heart of somebody that's experiencing joy, that's experiencing success, that's experiencing happiness. I think it was the Dalai Lama who said, when you can find joy, when you can delight in the joy of others, it increases the chance of you experiencing happiness by about 6.5 billion to one. Because approximately 6.5 billion to one. So, you know, those are pretty good odds. So seeing the benefit of expanding and resonating and connecting with the joy of others, can really feed you, can really feed the heart. And strange is, you know, when you hear it that way, it seems like, well, why wouldn't you want to do it? And yet there's so much maybe cultural conditioning towards feeling like happiness is kind of a zero-sum game. Like there's only so much happiness in the world, and if Ed here is happy, then, you know, he's got my happiness. I can't be happy if he's happy, you know. So even though that's crazy, that's not that uncommon for certainly for the way that I've thought for a lot of my life. Now, the third practice, again, starting with this foundational practice of metta, is karuna, or compassion. And in that practice, you're tuning into and empathizing with the pain and the suffering of others. And that one's maybe a little bit harder to understand. Why would you want to tune into the pain and the suffering of others? And for me, often the fear is that I'm going to be overwhelmed by it. You know, that it's just going to kind of like suck me in and, you know, it just be too much. So sometimes I respond to the suffering of others with indifference. Or I might respond to it with pity, like, I'm sorry that you're suffering and I want to help you end it because I just don't want to be around it. And this practice isn't either one of those. This karuna practice is about tuning into, witnessing, empathizing with, connecting to the pain and the suffering of others. And I just happen to I have this book, The Heart of the Buddha's Teaching, that was laying around my house. And so in the very first chapter, the very first two paragraphs, Thich Nhat Hanh writes a little bit, which I think might help us see what's the value of connecting with the pain of others. He writes, Buddha was not a god. He saw a human being like you and me, and he suffered just as we do. If we go to the Buddha with our hearts open, he will look at us, his eyes filled with compassion, and say, because there is suffering in your heart, it is possible for you to enter my heart. Please don't think that because you are unhappy, because there is a pain in your heart, that you cannot go to the Buddha. It is exactly because there is a pain in your heart that communication is possible. Your suffering and my suffering are the basic condition for us to enter the Buddha's heart and for the Buddha to enter our hearts. Those words of Thich Nhat Hanh reminded me of why did I come to Buddhist practice in the first place? And I recognized that it was when I had actually had an experience of really recognizing the suffering that was going on in my life. And rather than trying to find some way to dull it or to distract myself from it or to just try to get lost in some form of entertainment, that I really saw the wisdom in turning towards it and examining it. So the pain and the suffering in our hearts are often, I'm not sure if I could say always, but I believe often, what bring us to this practice. You know, doing this out of pure intellectual curiosity, I think, you know, might last for weeks or months, but I can't imagine it carrying you forward. So that's another, so that heart quality of compassion is something that can be developed intentionally through the Brahmavihara practice. And then the fourth Brahmavihara practice that's taught is called Upeka, or sometimes equanimity. And that's a more subtler form, I think, of this practice that involves you starting to see how the causes and conditions for the suffering that somebody's experiencing or the joy that somebody's experiencing came about. So starting to see the law of cause and effect, that what we've done in the past and what we're doing now set the conditions for the experience that we're having right now. So that although you can wish well for other people, you can wish that they be happy and that they be healthy, you can't actually free them from their karma. That what they've done in the past and what they're doing now and what they're intending is setting the conditions for what they're experiencing now. And so there can be a sense of settledness of the heart, in that you can't, recognizing that you can't take responsibility for other people's suffering, that that's based on their actions. The other part is that you do have to take responsibility for your past actions, that, you know, nobody can free you from the conditions that you helped create by what you did in the past. So this upeka practice can help you to free yourself from thinking that everything that's happening to you is just some gigantic cosmic mistake. You know, that the things you did in the past and the things you're doing now and your intentions are all helping set the conditions for the experience you're having. So to the extent that you can see that and make wiser choices about what you do, the chances for happiness in the future increase. So the Brahma Viharas are, I think, one of the foundational practices for helping condition the heart so that it gives you greater, not only a greater ability to tune in to the wisdom of the heart, but can also strengthen it. And then the other thing that I thought about in terms of working with the heart were the taking of the refuges. And I know you had a beautiful ceremony here in January where several people had gone through a refuge class and had undergone a ceremony where they, in a very public and deeply held, committed way, committed themselves to taking refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. So I'll ask you, how many of you know about the refuges, or have heard of them? Okay, quite a few. It's really something I think that's very important at some point to explore for yourself. What does that mean to take refuge in the triple gem, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha? In a very brief way, I'd say that taking refuge in the Buddha is not just taking refuge in some historical figure, but taking refuge in your own potential for waking up, your own potential for being free, and also taking refuge in those moments that you've experienced where you have been free. It's not like freedom is necessarily somewhere off in the future, that we do experience it. So, you know, taking refuge in whatever experience of freedom you have. Taking refuge in the Dharma. That's often means, you know, often interpreted as taking refuge in what the Buddha taught. And I think that's an important way of looking at it. Another way to look at it is just taking refuge in how do things actually work? You know, what's the truth? How does life actually operate? You know, things like understanding karma, understanding intention, you know, understanding things like the right effort, you know, like what thoughts and what experiences do you feed and nourish, and which do you weed out? You know, so kind of seeing how your actions can affect how your life goes. And also, of course, the other one is the Four Noble Truths. You know, kind of seeing the truth of suffering, seeing the truth of the cause of suffering, seeing the truth of the end of suffering, and seeing that there's a path, So all of those are things that it's possible to take refuge in. And then finally, taking refuge in the Sangha. I think in the Buddha's time, the Sangha was often defined as those people who had already kind of had an enlightenment experience. For me, taking refuge in the Sangha is taking refuge in the people I know that are on the path, on a spiritual path, that have had some experience, some taste of the value of turning towards the suffering that they're experiencing, right, rather than turning away from it. And so over the years that I've been doing this, I've been in a number of Kalyanamitta groups, just have individual friends. And it really helps to have Sangha. It really helps to have people that you can talk to that can help inspire you, support you, challenge you, instruct you, listen to you, talk to you. You know, this is not an easy practice. I mean, the instructions can be fairly simple, but keeping with it, you know, there's often moments of discouragement, often times of, you know, sort of forgetting, zoning out. So having Sangha in whatever way that looks for you, I think is a very important refuge, so that you're not trying to, I mean, in a certain way, you have to do this practice yourself. Nobody can do it for you. But on the other hand, having a Sangha like this, and maybe smaller groups, individual friends, can really help support and keep the practice going. And the reason I brought up the refuges is that they can be a refuge for the heart. I think the heart is a very, one of the images that I have is of tenderness and vulnerability and needing to be, and actually a little bit kind of like a shy animal, that it's not so easy to be in touch with it all the time. It knows when there's danger around, and will go and hide. And so offering a safe place, a refuge for the heart, is at some point, I think, is a real important process, so that as the heart feels safe and feels protected and feels nourished, feels listened to, that the wisdom that's available there will become apparent. There's a word in Pali called sadha, which is often translated faith or trust or confidence. And what it means is placing one's heart on. So having something reliable to place one's heart on can build trust. And trust is an important quality in order to continue with the practice, continue to open, continue to explore.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.